J Files on Double J.
How does a band release a genre-defining album, quit just as they're about to hit the big time, go off and create many other equally successful bands, only to come back together years later? For one of America's greatest post-hardcore bands, let's just say it's complicated. Hey, Gab Burke here, J-Files producer at Double J, and this is the J-Files podcast. And every week we dive into the Double J archive vault to bring you the stories behind the music. And today, it's the story of At The Drive-In. Hey! A band with an incredibly unique career trajectory. A group of hardworking artists who wanted to prove they were serious about music.
Their stickers are everywhere, their records are everywhere. I don't know what they sound like, but they're really f***ing serious.
The icons they worked with along the way.
Hello, what a leopard. I have your cub.
And the moment it all fell apart.
It's not something we're proud of, and, you know, we wish we made it work, but, you know, we were also lucky enough to be in the music business for a long time after that.
And to help tell this story, we've enlisted the help of lead singer Cedric Bixler-Zavala to share the journey with you in his own words.
It all started in a local park in El Paso called Madeline Park at a ditch, very small ditch that everyone used to go skateboarding in. It was me and Jim Ward and an acoustic guitar, and I just got off of a summer tour with a band I played in called Foss. I was playing drums for Foss, and I was also singing for a band called the Dreg Tones. You know, it was the end of those bands pretty much because it was just a summertime thing. Dreg Tones was my full-time band, but unfortunately at the time when we got home, our bass player had succumbed to cancer. So we lost him, and I was in dire need of a band that was serious about getting out of El Paso. And the only person in town at the time was Jim Ward. So he and I constructed the very first phases of At The Drive-In, silk screening our own merchandise in his garage, writing and performing in his living room. And our first concert was at a all-girls Catholic school called Loretto Academy, and I think it went over quite well. Then we just started organizing our own tours all across the country. That's kind of our origin story, is a Texas band just trying to get out of their small town.
And get out of their small town they did. Over the next few years, they were one of the hardest working bands around, embarking on grueling tours right across America. And Cedric remembers one particular gig that really changed things for them.
So those early gigs are really eye-opening. You really get to see what America's like, what it's like to go into a gas station and the person not take your money because of the color of your skin or because they might hear you speak Spanish. I see lots of violence across the states. I see people moving entire homes. I see just piss poor conditions as far as how bands are treated. And we're just forging new identities. We printed our own 7-inch. We're going out there and no one's buying it. And having just the time of our lives. It's one of the most greatest experiences I'll ever have. During that 95 tour, we happened to have played in front of the entire staff for Flipside magazine, which is a prominent U.S. punk magazine. And in attendance is the drummer of Mudhoney, and everyone feels really bad for us because we're not old enough to be even inside the bar, and there's no one there. It's just the staff of Flipside, which is six people at most. And they let us into play, and we play, and we sort of caught the attention of Blaze James Hurley, and he ends up calling us and sort of offers us the chance to record for Flipside. And that's kind of like the first explosion of what At the Drive-In was. Jim comes back into the fold. Brian's back on board. Then a friend of ours named Adam Amparan is on guitar. And we go to Los Angeles, California, and we record an album called Acrobatic Tenement. At this point, we have drafted a whole new era of At the Drive-In into the band, based on the purpose of finding like-minded individuals who want to just get out of El Paso. And we set out ambitiously to attempt a six-month tour of the United States. And we go for it, and we accomplish about 4 months of it. That was a big deal for us, and along the way we met people like AFI and Archers of Loaf, who helped us get gigs later on that would help propel us into the public eye. And we made a lot of friends along the way that just remember us as these little kids basically going door to door saying, hey, watch us, check us out. So that's kind of part two of the beginning and when things started getting good, which at that point is not really good at all. But the most important thing is that it's fun. It's like two kinds of artists, people who have a deadline and people who would do it no matter what, just because they have to get it out. And at that point, that's what At the Drive-In is, people that just have to get it out. And that's what makes it fun. I don't know if a lot of people understand this within our history, but it was that four-month tour that made the United States kind of say, like, wow, these guys are dead serious. Their stickers are everywhere. Their records are everywhere. I don't know what they sound like, but they're really f***ing serious. And it was the bulk of our work. And that's the high point, is the four-month tour, really, because that's the one that let the world know, at least in our small microcosm, that we were really, really f***ing serious.
They were serious, and they were definitely putting in the hard yards, and just as it was getting good, it all fell apart. You're going to hear about that very soon. But first, it was the genre-defining third album, Relationship of Command, that propelled At the Drive-In to the very top.
We were going to make Relationship of Command with Alex Newport, and Ross Robinson came into the picture, started showing up to shows and just sort of hounding us, kind of like really trying to sell him something, like, I'm the guy to record this. So we took a chance and let him do one song to see what he was like, and then we were sold. We had to sort of go back on our word with Alex Newport, which really sucked. That was just a painful conversation that our drummer had to have. So we're starting the album Relationship of Command, and we're signed to Digital Entertainment Network. Then we get the news that we're no longer on Digital Entertainment at work, and it sort of implodes. By default, we get put on Grand Royal Records. That's great news for us. We're really excited, because that's always been a label we wanted to be on. As we always had that magazine floating around. The magazine was great. It always featured some interesting stuff that we were really into. And in the middle of the record, Ross somehow finagles Iggy Pop to stop by, and he sings on this on one of our songs. And does the ransom note phone call on the record.
Hello, Mother Leopard. I have your cub. You
We're just
her.
Over the moon about it. We're just really flying high. And that's sort of the beginning of all the craziness, is the tour that happens after recording that record. We weren't even able to mix the record and be there because schedules were so hectic. And so that is the beginning of the clusterfuck that becomes being in the public eye.
And it was also the beginning of the end. A lot of Australian fans will remember an infamous gig in 2001 when At The Drive-In played the Big Day Out Festival. It was actually their first time to the country. And it was during their Sydney show that the band walked off stage about 10 minutes into their set.
I think it's a very, very sad day when the only way you can express yourself is through slam dancing.
But not before Cedric called the crowd sheep.
You're a sheep.
They have since suggested that they were actually protesting the overtly aggressive and unsafe crowd behaviour at the time, but it was a move that stunned fans, and it was just a few months later that the band called it a day.
We just sort of decided to call it a day because we wanted a vacation, but work was being put in front of us. And it became work after a while, and that was what was scary about it. As some people in management would say, you gotta hit it while you're hot. And that just sort of started grinding us, really. We weren't taken seriously about our exhaustion with the band, really. So we decided to call it a day. At that time, our communication skills were definitely not very sharp. It could have been dealt with a lot better. But it is what it is, and it happened for a reason. The two bands that splintered off from it, Sparta and Mars Volta, they happened for a reason. It was supposed to happen that way.
That wasn't where the story ended for At The Drive-In. In 2012, they announced a reunion and played a select few shows at Coachella, Fuji Rock, and Splendor in the Grass. And we're going to hear about that very soon. But a lot happened between 2001 and 2012. The members of At The Drive-In embarked on many other projects, from the Latin-tinged, dub-infused De Facto to a band that was hugely successful. Formed in 2001 in the wake of At The Drive-In split, guitarist Omar Rodriguez Lopez and singer Cedric Bixler Zavala formed a fiercely independent and experimental band called the Mars Volta. Omar spoke to Triple J's Scott Dooley about it in 2006.
You and Cedric have been working together for so long. How's your working relationship changed, particularly with this album?
It hasn't really. I mean, if anything, the only way our working relationship keeps changing is that we need to speak less and less, you know? And And for me, that's a good thing. I really hate intellectualizing music. I really hate trying to get too deep into it about emotions and feelings and what's this and what's that. I'm really a big fan of just intent and the first emotions that come out that we don't even really understand that is truly our subconscious at work. And the more we've been making music together now for, a little over 15 years. And I think we've just found more and more as we've worked together that there's fewer words that needs to be said between us. I hand over complete, pieces of music that I'm really excited about. And he listens to it and goes, ah, okay, I get it. And then he hands over his lyrics and I say, oh, okay, I get it. And then maybe there's like, okay, well, let's change this thing and let's move this over here and let's extend this or let's shorten this and there, we're done and let's move on to the next thing.
A lot of bands talk about kind of external pressures like record companies and stuff, and the Mars Volta seems to have managed to escape that. Is that true? Like, do you have just complete and utter freedom, or are there people saying, dude, you can't have a 17-minute single?
No way. No, if that were ever the case, I'd just quit playing music altogether. And for me, it's not an option. Yeah, there's never been a label person in the studio when we do something. There's never been a label person in the studio when we mix, or a manager or anything. It's all very much after we're done, we turn in the record and we say this is our latest work, and now it's their job to sell it. I think the only external pressure we ever have is getting paid, really. Because I do most of the work on my own studio, so we're completely autonomous from the label. I just sort of record when I want to, get the project done, end up pretty much going broke every record, and then hand the record in, and then I have to wait for all the bullshit, red tape and bureaucracy that's involved with a big label.
So the Mars Volta were together for 11 years and they released 6 albums. The Omar and Cedric music-making machine was in full flight. During this time, Omar was also collaborating with a whole bunch of musicians under the name of the Omar Rodriguez Group. And as the Mars Volta disbanded, he pursued an experimental art rock band called the Bosnian Rainbows. Cedric and Omar came back together in 2014 to form Anti-Mask. They enlisted the musical chops of Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers and Travis Barker from Blink-182. Anti-Mask was yet another example of Cedric and Omar working together. So Richard Kingsmill put it to Omar back in 2014. How was this band different from their previous bands?
I generally say that it's just, it's usually up to the listeners to decide. I mean, there's simple things that I can say, like, oh, the songs are more concise and, they're shorter songs and things like that I can pinpoint. The rest of it's harder to really explain because, we're inside of it. I think for people from the outside, they can sort of make their own calculation about it, But it's sort of, since we just came out of the band where we were making long 17-minute songs that are complicated, it's only natural that now we're making simpler, shorter music.
Yeah. Well, I wrote down the word straightforward. There's something very straightforward about the sound of Anti-Mask.
Yeah, and it's really cool, and it's really invigorating too. Because, like I said, you just go, like anyone else, you just go through phases in life, And so, this is almost a return to like when we were teenagers and we were playing in punk groups. It's like that sort of arrangement, sort of just very straightforward and to the point. But also with the experience and the knowledge that we've had, for the past, 18 years of being on tour. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. With the Mars Volta, do you think, looking back on it now, that the career of the Mars Volta had just run its course? You recorded the records, you explored all that music. Did it feel like it was just time to end it?
It just felt like that at the time, yeah. It just felt like it was time to, you know, sort of move on and do something new. And we know It's Always There as our as another home that we created for ourselves, you know. And it's just, you know, we did At the Drive-In for 8 years. We did Mars Volta for 13 years. And then luckily, you know, that's what's so cool about the something like art or music is that you can do that and it's not heavy. Like if you're in a marriage, that's heavy. You can't just after 13 years be like, okay, I just want to do something else now. You know, it's irresponsible. But with music, it's almost necessary. You know, and it's not as serious of a thing. You know, as like a marriage or something. I mean, it is in terms of that you feel that way. You feel that type of connection. But you can change the sort of the name and the personality of it. You know, and explore different avenues.
But with the end of the Mars Volta, Omar, I mean, everyone sort of talks about the relationship you have musically with Cedric. Was there a chance that the next project you were going to work on wasn't going to be with Cedric, or did you always have in mind that you'd continue to work together?
No, we always knew we'd work together. You know, it's just people tend to blow things out of proportion in the exterior world, and that's fine. That's part of what is supposed to happen, you know, sensationalism and everything, but we always knew. I mean, you know, we've been a couple for 24 years, you know. I mean, we've been making music since the late 80s, and then people came to know us through At the Drive-In. So it's just, you know, eventually we were going to have, we've only had two arguments in 24 years of being best friends. You know, one was what to do with Volta, and the first one was because back in 1989, I told him that Glenn Danzig from the Misfits sounded like Jim Morrison to me, you know, so we got mad at each other, you know, so I mean, that in itself is pretty remarkable to have, you know, to have people who are together pretty much every day of their lives and like, you know, live together up until their 30s, only have two disagreements, you know, is pretty remarkable in and of itself.
Jim Ward was also pretty busy after At the Drive-In disbanded. He, along with drummer Tony Hiyar and guitarist Paul Hinojos, branched off to form Sparta. Now, Paul quit Sparta in 2005 to join the Mars Volta, and Keely Davis joined in his place. And it's Keely Davis who currently plays in the newly reformed At the Drive-In because Jim Ward hasn't rejoined the band. We're going to get to that soon. So much incredible music was created between 2001 and 2012. So many different bands and so many different combinations of musicians, all created out of the ashes of At the Drive-In. But as I mentioned earlier, the breakup in 2001 was definitely not the end. There was still more to come. In 2017, they released their first new album in 17 years. More on that very soon. In 2012, when they were here for Splendor in the Grass, only just newly reformed, Richard Kingsmill caught up with Cedric and Jim backstage to find out how they were feeling about it all.
When you got back into the room and started playing again, did you have second thoughts about the split and think, well, maybe we should have pushed it just a little bit longer?
I think everything happens for a reason, and we stopped when we stopped, and it was a good time for all of us to stop. I don't think, I've always said, and now that we're all in the same room, I think we can all agree or disagree or whatever, but I think that when we stopped, it's because our band at that point couldn't be that band. Like, we weren't built to be that band, you know?
For a lot of spectators, it was a weird time to break, though.
Well, because people think that your intention is to be famous and rich. And if that's not your intention, where we came from, that was a second thought. It wasn't anything. We never thought about that stuff. So, yeah, it would be weird if our goal was to be rich and famous to stop at that point. But for us, we cared about something beyond that. And it was time to stop. And we did, you know, for whatever reason, it's all between the five of us, it's all settled and we're all good. We're all happy.
Yeah.
But that being said, if you can't exist in that world, then you can't exist in that world. And we couldn't. So
A lot of people around you, especially on the business side of the fence, they must have been pulling their hair out and screaming at you to because, not make this decision. Was it like that?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but because that's their paycheck. They're like, why would you stop before I make $1 million off of you? That's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
You know? But for us, it was like, I would rather stop before I die doing this because I don't care if you make $1 million.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me. how much money you make.
Yeah. The career of the band up until that point was really fascinating, because a lot of bands say the best period of the career, I remember REM saying this as well, driving around in the van, covering all those miles in the States, doing those shitty gigs, putting it all together, putting the pieces of the puzzle together as you went, was the best time of the band's career. Forget the successful part of it, that was the best part.
Yeah.
When you look back at the drive-in, Cedric, was that the best part of being in this band?
The success of just, like, when we all applauded and we landed an airplane in Europe, that was like success. When we actually got out of El Paso and played to nobody, that was success. You know, those are the smallest things. The fact that we got a van, the fact that the printing of our first 7-inch came out, the fact that we could be in a garage scrim printing our own t-shirts, that was success, you know, because that's at least for me, when I watched Another State of Mind, that movie with Social Distortion going on tour and they pretty much break up when they get back home. Like, I learned so much from there, you know. Band gets paid in pennies, they play to nobody, you know, they're going across paving the road, which we all take for granted now, but because of those bands like Youth Brigade and even Minor Threat and Social Distortion, in that movie it just showed you how to do it, and it showed you that it wasn't for money, it was really for the fun of doing it.
And 5 years after that, the first new work from At The Drive-In in 17 years was released. Their fourth album, Interalia. Cedric spoke to Double J's Miff Warhurst about how they managed to get their At The Drive-In vibe back.
Well, we really wanted to make sure that we paid attention to what it is that people liked about our last record. And I think we made a conscious effort to avoid making a 2017 record as if though we just had all this new idea for a new direction, which was, that could be really easily accomplished. I think anyone can come and do that and try to redefine it, but I think you would lose a lot of people that way, and you would lose a lot of the sort of mystical legacy of what people remembered it to be. So we had a lot of conversations and sort of held that as, you know, held our last record as the mark to, I guess, live up to. But I don't know if we lived up to it, but I just know that that was like this sort of parameter or the rule, or I don't know what you call it, but it was like, remember what you were thinking like back then. Remember how you wrote back then. Remember how there wasn't so much like music theory involved. Or remember what it was like to be a young person, but sonically, you know?
And after a long and I'm sure exhausting and intensely creative journey with so many highs and lows, how do they feel about it all now? Here's drummer Tony Hiyar.
We were lucky enough to kind of break all over the world at the same time, but unlucky in the sense of that we didn't know how to operate in that world. You know, we operate in a world that where we struggled all the time, and we imploded. And it's not something we're proud of, and, you know, we wish we made it work, but, you know, we were also lucky enough to be in the music business for a long time after that. None of us had to stop. Everyone, you know, continued in bands and became better musicians. And when we decided to get back together in 2012, it became a thing that, you know, this is what we like. This is, you know, these are the people these are our brothers. These are the people we care for. And we decided to do those 10 shows, and those 10 shows ended up being great. And then in October of 2015, you know, we decided, look, whoever crosses the line is committing to touring in 2016, writing a record during that time, and then recording at the end of that year and touring again on that cycle. And here we are now in, you know, September 2017, and really enjoying it and enjoying the process. And now it's, you know, I think one of my main goals, at least, is to get off people's bucket list. I don't want to be on people's bucket list of live shows. I just want to be a band that, you know, is back together and is proving that, you know, we did, you know, that we can get your respect again and not, you know, not fall apart at the seams.
All right, that's it from me. And if you're listening via a podcast app, Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you get a fresh new episode in your feed each week. And you can let me know what you think of this podcast as well. And what's next on the J-Files? I'm Gab Burke. Catch you later.
The J-Files.